This is the IBJ podcast for the week of November the 2nd, 2020, brought to you by the law firm Krieg DeVault. I'm Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. As I mentioned up top, this episode is going to post on November the 2nd. Hopefully, I don't need to tell you what happens on November the 3rd. Now, from there, just about anything can happen. We probably won't know the winner of the presidential election on Tuesday night. We might not know on Wednesday night either. Several of the swing states aren't counting any early ballots until Tuesday, and the tabulation could take a while. So this week on the podcast, we're going to look way ahead, because no matter what happens in this election, it's a good bet that most of us will still need to plan for retirement. You might remember an ad campaign a while back from one of the big financial advisors about finding your retirement number. In effect, how much do you need to have saved to sail into your retirement years, your golden years? I've always assumed that it was $1 million, and that's kind of how I've been planning my investments. That very likely is based on something I heard a decade ago, and the only reason I remembered it is because it's a big round number. In reality, you need to take into consideration a dizzying number of variables. And the biggest one, by far the most important one, you very likely won't know until it's too late. And the operative number, the one that you get after you determine your retirement number, is the only one that should concern you for the foreseeable future. I've asked Pete Dunn, aka Pete the Planner, to explain how all this works. He's our guest for this week's edition of the podcast, which I should warn you, gets a little squirrely here and there. We both were digging out from particularly long weeks, so we might sound a teeny bit frazzled as we work through actually several issues with planning for retirement, but I think that we bring it all home in the end. Here's our conversation. I'm pleased to invite back to the IBJ podcast virtual studio, Pete Dunn. How are you, Pete?
Good. I like the changes you've made in the studio. It looks great.
Thanks. How do you like the dog that's sleeping over here to my left?
Always leave a sleeping dog rest. Is that the cliche that doesn't exist?
Sleeping dogs lie. I think so.
Okay, good.
I think that has something to do with investing that we're not going to explore right now. And actually, before we get to this week's subject, I did want to quickly acknowledge that the stock market has had a tough few days. I think as of this morning, the S&P 500 was down like 5% for the week. Though I think it bounced back today, or some point today it had bounced back. This isn't anything like the crash that we had back in March. But I wanted to ask for just a quick read on volatility. My sense, you know, like we always say, is the market hates uncertainty. Right now there are at least like 50 things to be uncertain about. One of them is the election, of course. The other is a spike in COVID numbers. I'm going to assume that your advice for investors is don't make any rash decisions.
Yeah, I was actually talking to my financial advisor this morning about this very topic. And what was interesting is that we all want to time the market so bad. I don't know why we do. I don't know if we're just trying to get over and get a victory in the year of losses, which is the 2020. But Mason, there's no prudence in trying to time the market, especially right now. Everyone knows there's volatility right now. Everyone knows there will be volatility on election week. And that's to say that's your short-term outlook. Your short-term outlook should not impact your long-term investing strategy. And that's a tough concept for people to understand that, hey, you know it's going to go down or you know it's going to go up. Just relax and don't do anything. That's not a fun message that people expect to hear from what would be perceived to be a prudent financial person.
So that's my strategy. Just kind of forget that I have investments and just let it go.
Kind of. Yeah, I mean, kind of, because I think sometimes we're tying our stress levels and how much we're caring about every breaking news piece. We're tying that to our financial future when there isn't that much of a connection. I mean, you and I are connected to the short-term volatility that's happening in these couple weeks, but it really doesn't matter. And again, that's tough to hear. It's tough to believe, but it just doesn't matter.
Well, let's move to our podcast subject, which is sort of related, and that's setting your goal for retirement. This is also the subject of your column for IBJ this week. And you start off, which I love, by reminiscing about this ad campaign from a few years back from some big investment firm about finding your retirement number. Like, you know, like it's like you literally can roll some dice
just come up with your goal.
Yeah, it was a brilliant campaign because it got everyone thinking. And the concept of your number, of course, Mason, is what pile of money? What's the total pile of money you need to be able to just walk away from your job, right? It's like, what's your number? And it was smart because it got people thinking. But the reality is, it just doesn't work that way. I mean, if you had a number you were trying to hit by a particular age, that works. But there is no overarching number because of the nature of how retirement income works. And so what I wrote about this week is, what's the real number you should actually care about and how do you get to it? And it's, frankly, it's a little complex.
Can I just interject quickly and say,
please?
I occasionally would get my retirement number mixed up with my sleep number.
Maybe this week when you're overworked and there's so much news happening.
And then, well, I was thinking about this afternoon when I was getting ready for the podcast, and it occurred to me that what we really need to know when planning for retirement is what our dirt nap number is.
Yeah. Oh, look at that.
I do like that.
I want to know how long you workshopped that and who you bounced that off of.
Man, I do this every day.
That's good stuff. You know what? The fact of the matter is you're 100% right.
Okay.
The number that really matters in retirement planning to begin this process is your death date. And that's macabre. It's not fun to talk about. I know you and I were sort of laughing before we started recording of like how stressful things are in every aspect of life right now. But I decided to loosen it up, everybody, by talking about the day you die.
What a relief.
Yeah, but that's the complexity of retirement planning, because you don't know when you're going to die. And if you did, you would make decisions in a completely different way. You would equally distribute your assets over the course of your remaining days. And while you could arguably make a behavioral mistake, which would lead to problems, there's no uncertainty of to how long your money has to last. Unfortunately, Mason, what people do is they assume they're going to live 15 years, so therefore they can take a higher amount out of their retirement. They can say things like, oh, well, everyone in my family dies early, or they can assume they live forever, and therefore they don't take much retirement distribution income at all. And so I'm not suggesting that you and I spend a lot of time trying to convince people they need to choose their death date, but that is the reason why this is so complicated. So we have to take a different approach.
Right. Okay. So let's say I'm some dopey guy. I'm a dopey client of Pete the Planner. And I come in and I say, hey, what is this retirement number thing about? Walk me through it. What is it that we're really talking about here?
Okay, so what's great about this concept of your number, which with the commercial, again, theoretically, is this idea of how much money do you have to retire? This is a question, Mason, that I get all the time. I mean, I truly get in various forms all the time, like, Pete, I always heard you need $2 million and your house paid off. Or I was in Iowa before this whole thing started. I was sitting in a friend's office and he's like, hey, man, I always heard you just need $5 million. It's always some round number.
Man, right? I always heard a million. I thought I was like close already.
Well, I mean, we can actually talk what a million looks like. We can work through this. This is fun. We'll call this like podcasting with a financial calculator in your hand. I mean, it's a good time. But while that is neat to think about this big number, the real thing that you and I should walk around with on a regular basis, the real thing on the front of our mind should be, how much money should I save a month? That's it. That's the only number that actually matters. It's the only prudent number to think about, because it leads to action. Mason, let's say you figure out your number's $2 million, right? I mean, don't get caught up. But let's say it's $2 million. Are you just going to walk around all day on 4 hours sleep going, $2 million, $2 million? What does that do? But if we find out that that means you have to save $1,163 a month for the rest of your working career, that matters.
That's a big number.
It's a hypothetical number.
Okay, good.
But we can give you the real number. I mean, I got spreadsheets for days. I excel at it.
You got to be kidding.
Yeah, well, look, if you're going to hit me with the dirt nap, I can hit you with my Excel jokes.
Oh, my goodness.
Can I give you an example?
Yeah, give me an example. Here, remember, I'm dopey. I don't know what you're talking about.
Let's say from scratch right now, you want to save $1 million by the 25 years from now. Okay. This is a little fun with calculators here. A little fun with calculators. $1 million saved over the next 25 years. You're starting at zero. And we're going to assume you can earn an 8% rate of return over that time frame. What do you think you'd have to save a month in order to have $1 million 25 years from now at 8%?
This is a compounded 8%. Okay. A year. Did you say a year or a month?
Save per month.
25 years?
25 years. I feel like you're searching for your abacus somewhere in your living room. What are you doing?
I'm going to ask my dog. She says 400.
Well, she's doing dog math. That's not right.
Okay.
It's 1,052.
Yikes.
Okay. And so this is where this gets interesting. Mason, if someone comes up to me and says, hey, my number's this or that, and they're 23 years old, I know that they've got at least 44 years until they are at retirement age, which is age 67. If I have this conversation with someone who's 51, I know they've got 16 years until they're at full retirement age. That's why this concept of what's your number and that this number could somehow translate to someone else's situation is sort of pointless, because the real number is this monthly commitment to whatever your number ends up being.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
The IBJ Podcast is brought to you by Krieg DeVault, a trusted and dynamic law firm representing a wide variety of local, regional, and national clients. Committed to each other and to every client, Krieg DeVault prides itself on integrity, professionalism, respect, and excellence. Financial institutions, global manufacturers, national healthcare providers, and successful organizations of all sizes and market focus rely on Krieg DeVault to create innovative and successful business solutions. Connect today at www.kriegdevault.com.
Okay, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast. We're speaking this week with Pete the Planner about finding the numbers you need in order to get yourself in good financial shape for retirement.
Let's assume here that I am actually going to take this responsibility into my hands here. I'm going to go find a financial planner and I'm going to say, tell me what my monthly number is. Are they going to know what I'm talking about? Is this a widely accepted concept?
They may call it different things. You know how marketing departments get involved, right? They try to dress it up and call it something fancy. And I'm not saying that a normal run-of-the-mill financial advisor or just go find one would disagree with the concept that this is important. But I even think within the financial industry, we get too caught up in what the balance is as opposed to the work that it takes to get to the balance. And even in the column this week, I explored this idea of there's a lot of things to focus on. There's a lot of variables, but we choose the wrong ones, right? We choose to worry about the rate of return. We choose to worry about inflation. We choose to worry about tax rate. And it's not that you should be dismissive of any of those three things, but you can only affect what you put in more or less, yet we're putting so much energy and time and focus into the other three.
So yeah, again, I'm trying to get to kind of a bottom line here. My dog and I, we can't do this by ourselves. We are going to need to have somebody help us with this. It sounds like it's pretty complicated math. And a lot of variables to worry about.
Okay, so here are the variables, but plain and simple. How much money do you have right now? I'm just giving you the questions. I'm not asking you these questions. Okay. How much money is saved now? How much you put in away each month? How many years until you're going to retire? What is the average rate of return? And then beyond that, we get into distribution rate, which that's the percentage of money you're going to pull from your investments once you retire. It's called the distribution rate commonly, or the withdrawal rate. And then we have to think about the tax rate in retirement. And finally, we have to think about inflation, the fact that our dollars lose buying power as time passes. Those are the primary variables of figuring out when you're going to retire. I think the best place to start, very frankly, because it's just easier to do the math, is you pick a year when you want to retire. I mean, if you're trying to come up with your monthly number, you go to your advisor and you say, hey, advisor, I want to retire when I'm 64 years old. And she'll look you in the eye, ask you a couple questions, and she'll have a number for you within 5 to 10 minutes.
I have a parenthetical here. Social Security. You know, when I sort of imagine retiring, I think, you know, well, you know, I've got a pretty good amount of money here, but, you know, I expect to get whatever, I don't know, $1,400 a month in Social Security. And that'll really help. That'll put me over. Is that something that an advisor would take into account? And number two, do we have any reason to believe it's going to be there in 20 years?
Are you ready to have people start getting mad? Advisors will ask you if you want to take that into account. And most advisors will make that judgment themselves based on how old you are. And I'm now going to express a personal opinion. I feel like most of this episode, I've been expressing simply mathematics. And now I'm going to express an opinion in my own personal strategy. I am not counting on, that was a sort of a math joke, the fact that Social Security will be there for me. I'm 42 years old. I know I look much older. I'm only 42. I just don't see it happening. I really don't. And there was a lot of articles this week about how the realities of the pandemic, the realities of this recession, and even President Trump's tax strategy as he looks at, you know, making the payroll tax cuts permanent and how that impacts the funding that goes towards Social Security. Social Security is a big problem. Within the next 10 years, it's a big problem.
Oh boy. Okay.
Well, no, I didn't think I would say. I've known it's a problem. People who follow this stuff know it's a problem, but it came into focus this week that it's a problem within the next 10 years of, okay, well, everyone's getting a 25% reduction of what we thought they were getting, or you cut off an age, and this is anarchy right here. You cut off at an age and you say, okay, only the people above this age are going to get it, yet all the workers have to still pay into it. I mean, that just seems like a loony conspiracy theory.
Or you push the age at which you can accept the money to whatever, 80?
I think that's the most likely solution for you and me. Our full retirement age is age 67. I think the most likely solution is that gets pushed back to 70 to 72 to 75. The concern there, as you can imagine, is that the workforce has enough trouble. I'm trying to choose my words carefully here. Has enough trouble finding positions for people in that age range and keeping them on, right, wrong, or otherwise, right? I think age discrimination is a very real thing. And that problem is made worse if you stretch the age into the 70s.
Yeah, you know, I had a buddy who, maybe this isn't the world's best example, but I think that he retired at maybe 68, and he built in about 4 years in which he was going to work at Walmart.
Yeah, you know, that it's funny. That's sort of a financial industry trope. This, are you going to end up being a Walmart greeter? And for years, financial advisors somewhat flippantly use it as an example of, you know, this could be your reality if you don't do good planning. But I think we've learned with a recovering economy, jobs like a Walmart greeter or whatever that is meant to represent, they're not going to be that readily available. I mean, you're not going to find someone who's struggling in retirement going to go get this gig that other people are competing for in a recovering economy. I think it's really tough right now to be a recently retired person or someone who planned on retiring the next 2 or 3 years. I think everyone has it bad right now, but those people have the most at risk. And I'm saying that respective of the people who are completely marginalized and have no assets or income at all.
Okay. Well, so assuming that, I mean, this podcast is for people who haven't already done all this work and who haven't already hired their advisor and they've already got their plan set up. What are the one or two most important things that I need to do right now?
Pick your year. No matter how bad, you don't want to pick your year. Most people don't want to pick the year they retire because they like to hold on that it can move up. Well, I don't want to pick my year because I'd like it to be earlier than it really is. You can't plan that way. You have to pick the year and you can adjust it after that. Again, I was talking to my advisor this morning. We were putting some different models together about different stuff. They were looking decent. And I said to him, hey, let's break this thing. Let's input some data that makes this thing fall apart, because that's how we will know whether it's a strong plan or not. So you got to pick a year. That's a number one. Number two, you have to really come to terms with what your lifestyle is. Mason, I think a lot of people will just pick a number out of thin air to say, this is what I'd like in retirement. And they don't consider the fact that they may have never actually lived at that lifestyle, or they've never lived at that lifestyle in the last 2 decades. And you can't expect someone to change their habits cold turkey after they retire. There's so much excitement of having 168 hours a week to do whatever you want for the first time in a long time that you spend like a sailor on leave. I remember when I was a financial planner, I had a client that spent 12%, and for those that don't know, that's a bad idea, 12% of their net worth in their first year of retirement because they were having so much fun with the freedom they had when they probably should have been closer to 3.5% to 4%. And if they had kept at that pace, they would have spent through their nest egg within 12 years. And then at that point in time, what do you do?
I was curious, is it feasible typically to continue to live at the same lifestyle that you were living in when you had work? I mean, can I expect to pretty much continue what I've been doing?
Yes and no. The categories sort of change, right? So your medical expenses likely go up.
Right.
There's certain categories that go up. Utilities go up. Your transportation costs typically go down because you're not driving back and forth all the time. You don't go through cars as much, so that goes down. Your food budget typically goes up. Your gift budget and holiday budget typically goes up. Your travel budget goes up. And I saw you raise your eyebrows, which is always a good thing to discuss on a radio interview, a visual. But when I said about gift budget, and it's a weird, obvious reality. As you get older, and if you have children, they tend to have children, and then you got a growing family and you're buying for your kid's life partner. I mean, you're just buying for all these additional people. And you find that people, as they age, end up spending more on gifts. I will also say you tend to be more charitable with both money and time as you get older. So it sort of shifts. I think a person should always practice living at their retirement lifestyle before they retire, which includes the discretionary spending amount. If I'm a working person and I want to go out to eat and go out whenever I want or go on vacation whenever I want, I can refill the coffers with work income. Once you get to retirement, once you start that spend down, if you spend down at the wrong rate, it's a permanent move. Once you turn that faucet of income on and you turn it on too high and the handle breaks, water's flowing.
Because when I'm retired, I still should expect to get some kind of, or I should tool it, so I should expect to get some kind of return on my savings.
Yeah, but and that's the, again, I feel like you should have just been in my discussion with my advisor this morning, right? Because it's that rate of return in retirement is likely going to be a little less aggressive than what you got during your accumulation phase. Remember, there's two phases: accumulation phase, distribution phase. Accumulation phase, you can generally take more risks. As you get closer to distribution phase, which is retirement, you start to bear down a little bit. And then in retirement, you bear down even more, and there's tax sensitivity to it. This is a very giant commercial for everyone having a financial advisor. Do you realize that? And by the way, I'm not a financial advisor. Don't call me, call someone good, right? And I can explain the concept to you, but this is what advisors do. They distill this information down. They help you not make really obvious mistakes that people want to make, like timing the market. But you just go in there and say, I'd like to retire in 2032, the year 2032. This is, I think, the amount of money I want to have. This is how much money I have now. Tell me how much I need to save each month. That's the conversation. If you leave the office without that monthly amount, I would question how good that financial advisor really is.
There, that's what I needed. Okay. I'm going to make a mental note. I'm going to bookmark this tab in my head. I'm going to come back to this interview in a few days. I'm going to listen again, but that is what I needed to know.
Yeah. I would love if a bunch of people comment on the IBJ.com story where this podcast lives, that they went and got that number from their advisor. I don't want them to list their number. We don't need to have privacy issues. I would just love it if just like dozens and dozens and hundreds of people got that number. I would feel like this was a fantastic use of both of our time.
Okay, great. Well, then let's build on this the next time we talk. Who knows when that'll be?
Such a positive outlook.
I know. Hang in there, buddy. I really appreciate your time.
No, it's my pleasure. We'll get through this. We have to.
All right. I will talk to you soon, okay?
Thanks, Mason.
My thanks again to Pete Dunn. Folks, before you get on with the rest of your week, I'd like to point out a few of the strong stories in this week's edition of IBJ. Governor Eric Holcomb has said repeatedly that he'd be willing to reverse course on the state's reopening plan if the data indicated that the pandemic was worsening. Lindsay Erdody explores why Holcomb hasn't taken the step back now that confirmed cases, hospitalizations, deaths, and positivity rates have surged. And John Russell reveals how much fine-grained and site-specific data the state collects on the spread of COVID-19 that it declines to share with the public. Also in this week's issue, IPS Superintendent Alicia Johnson discusses the reopening of the state's largest public school system and what administrators have learned so far. Again, you can find these stories in IBJ's latest print edition or online at IBJ.com. I'm not going to lie to you, it's quite a bit easier to access IBJ's nearly bottomless trove of stories and statistics about central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for authoritative and actionable information that you're not going to find anywhere else, and you can be sure that we'll be all over the repercussions of the election and what it means for central Indiana. So just go to IBJ.com, click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.